Hey, have you started your taxes yet? Or are you one of those people who waits to the last minute? Larry Mueller here. I never wait to the last minute. And usually by this time, I will have a good start on my taxes. Maybe you have as well. Maybe you have some questions. And if you do, you have come to the right place because we have Mary Mellum with us of Ashwaubenon Tax Professional. She's does a great job and has been with us many times to talk about your taxes and mine. She and her husband, David, have been in the tax business for more than 30 years. They serve individuals. They consult to tax professionals. They teach tax seminars around the country. And she always has great advice. I hope you'll join in with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Mary Mellum, welcome back. Great to have you with us.
Thank you, Larry. It's good to be here.
Well, there is a lot we can talk about today. I know one thing you wanted to talk about was delayed returns, and fill us in on that.
The Congress passed a law in order to circumvent the fraud that has been going on with tax returns and the filing of tax returns. And they mandated that certain types of returns could not be processed until February 15th, which we've just gone by, and then it will take time for those refunds to get out. Those type of returns are the kinds that have what I call free money attached, earned income credit, and the additional child tax credit. These are credits that are refundable credits. You don't have to owe tax in order to get those back. And so in an effort to slow down the identity theft idea of creating tax returns to get money from the government, they initiated first this law that said no return with those items will be processed before February 15th. And also this year, they changed the sending in W-2s. For employers who issue W-2s, they had to be out by January 31st to their employees, which is a normal process.
Yep.
But this year, the copy that goes to the Social Security Administration also had a January 31st deadline. Now, that's a whole month earlier than in the past.
Okay.
And the purpose is to get those things in and processed so that when the IRS is matching up the Social Security number with the data, they have more to work with.
That makes sense. And there are verifications and verification codes and things like that as well, aren't there?
Yes. IRS, again, working with Congress, has established a verification code on certain W-2s. It started out as a pilot program last year, and it has been expanded this year. I believe that there are 8 national payroll services that are participating in this program. And the listeners might look at their W-2 for this code. It's a 12-digit number. It's a mixture of numbers and letters.
Okay.
That appears on certain W-2s. And when filing the tax return, if they're doing it electronically, and I assume that the personal electronic systems will use this as well, that by inputting that code that appears on their W-2, that it helps ensure that that's the real W-2 and not a phony.
Yeah, that's very good. And aren't there identity pins as well? Or
yes. For people who have been victims of identity theft or feel that they've been victimized, the IRS some years ago created a 6-digit PIN. And the PIN is, in certain cases you can apply for the PIN, and in certain cases the IRS will automatically issue that PIN. And for someone who has been subject to identity theft that has that PIN, when they file their tax return, that PIN must be inputted into their tax return so that the IRS recognizes it as legitimate.
Yeah, so well, that's just good protection for those of us taxpayers.
Well, as taxpayers, this fraud has resulted in more than $1 billion of phony returns being issued.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
So even though, to some extent, it's a pain in the neck with some of these things, it really is to our benefit to use these things to help speed up things and assure that it's real.
And don't they also use driver's license numbers?
This is a new program this year. And this is a state program rather than a federal program. Certain states have mandated that the filing of a tax return include an ID of the person filing it. A driver's license or a picture ID are the two sources of it. Wisconsin does not mandate it, but our software enables us to do it. And again, it's one more step on the state level to help identify the real person.
You know, and as you say, maybe a little extra work, but you know what? You want to get your money back if you've got money coming, or, you know, make sure that process is okay for you and it's all on the up and up. I think it's all a good thing.
I think it certainly helps all of us taxpayers.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know what? Every one of our lines is already full. So let's take some calls. And John and, John, we'll get to you in a minute. Let's go to Lenny in McFarland first. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have had a granddaughter living with me for the last 5 years, and she was ill for better than 6 months of this past year and earned very little. And I asked her if she would object to my claiming her as a dependent, since I have provided more than half of her sustenance here.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never done this before. Don't know how to do it.
Yeah. Is it possible, Mary Mellum, for her to do that?
First of all, the age and the earnings of this granddaughter are important to know.
Yeah.
If the granddaughter is under the age of 24 and a full-time student for at least 5 months of the year, she's what we call a qualifying child. Mm-hmm. And the set of rules for that do not dictate that she earns a certain amount of money or prohibit her, but it says that she can't provide more than half of her support.
Okay.
If she doesn't meet that criteria, then we call a qualifying relative. And the rules are a little bit stickier for a qualifying relative. And the qualifying relative must have more than half of their support provided by the person that wants to claim them. And in addition to that, that person can earn no more than the exemption amount, which this year is $4,050. So if she meets that criteria, she could include the granddaughter on her tax return with the Social Security number and the other information that needs to be provided.
Okay.
Okay, I don't think we'll make the cut.
Too bad. Too bad, Lenny, but thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take John and Eau Claire next with a question. John, hi.
Hi, I'm calling on behalf of a friend who has no income, but did have an IRA rolled over, and the full amount of federal taxes was taken off. I think it was $14,000, and $2,800 was taken off, 20% off the top for federal taxes. Now, the question is, does the IRS consider a disability to be post-traumatic stress disorder? Because apparently, if the person is 58 or above and has a disability, then that penalty, early withdrawal penalty, does not apply. So how does one fill out taxes to get the refund back that the federal government put on the
IRA? Person, yeah, okay.
Okay, let me address this for just a minute. A rollover is something that goes from the pension. You don't keep it, and is put into either another pension or an IRA. And it can be a direct transfer where the person doesn't touch the money, or It can be, if done within 60 days, a check that you take physically from one location to the other. Right. In the scenario that you have described, what this person, this would not be a direct transfer. So there must have been a check cut, and the check right. is for the difference between $14,000 and $2,800.
Correct. It was not a rollover. I misspoke. It was basically the IRA had been cashed in for living expenses.
Okay. Then that is certainly a tax filing event. So there is income of $14,000, and depending on their situation, however it plays out, the question is, if this person is under 59 and a half, are they able to get out of the 10% penalty? And disability is one of the excuses to getting out of the 10% penalty. And they would need to file a Form 5329 in order to tell the government, essentially, that they're disabled. And it's permanent and total disability is the criteria for disability.
Would post-traumatic stress disorder be considered permanent disability?
I don't know. You know, I'm not one to judge what a disability is, how that reacts on that person. Are they receiving Social Security? Are they unable to work? Those are the things that you would want to look at to determine what it is. Possibly a letter from a doctor saying that he's declared that they're disabled.
Yeah.
Some kind of backup like that.
Okay.
All right.
Great.
Good luck. Yeah. John, thanks a lot, and thanks for helping out your friend as well. Appreciate it. Peter in Brookfield, your turn. Hi, Peter. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, I've got a question. You guys spent a lot of time at the beginning of the show talking about the fraudulent tax returns and stuff and how the government is telling you to get your returns back early. And I noticed for the last 5 years or so, I would have loved to have got my return in already, but I'm still waiting for forms from my brokerage firms. And why and how did they get an extra 2 weeks to get this information out when everybody else has to have the information sent out by the end of January? It's really irritating.
Okay.
It may be irritating, but there are a lot more regulations and things that the brokers have to jump through for the purpose of filing the tax returns. About 2010, brokers were required to provide basis information as a part of the brokerage statement. And the compilation of that information for all the sales that go on and the determination of what is a qualified dividend versus what is an ordinary dividend takes a whole lot longer than it does to prepare the 1099s and W-2s for other things. So I know that it's a pain in the neck waiting for it, but it certainly is worthwhile information. And I personally would rather push my tax return out a little bit longer and have the proper correct information that they provide.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks a lot for calling, Peter. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. At 2 o'clock today, I hope you'll join Kathleen Dunn and her guest, a local author, to talk about his sensitive and almost humorous memoir about caring for his father who was suffering from dementia. That's at 2. Right now, taking a look at your taxes with Mary Mellum of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. And one open line at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And let's turn to Bill in Ocano Falls next. Bill, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. Hey, I've got a question, and it has to do with if there's any advantage or benefit to filing individually versus jointly if you're both retired on fixed incomes to avoid or minimize paying taxes, additional taxes.
Sure.
Is there any advantage?
There can certainly be advantages when there are incomes that are different in the sense of the numbers. There is one difficult situation in the state of Wisconsin. Wisconsin is a marital property state, and as a marital property state, your income of a husband and wife gets all dumped in one bucket and evenly divided between the two. That goes for income, that goes for withholding, and so you're not really achieving a lot of differences. Both returns are going to look a lot alike, so you're not able to take the swings in the tax rates and things like that. The other thing with filing jointly or filing married separately, if one itemizes, the other has to itemize. Also, there are certain credits that can't be taken on married separate returns. So sometimes we have married separate returns done for reasons other than tax with those things. And the only other way around that is if people have either premarital agreements or marital agreement that says from this day forward, mine is mine and yours is yours, that's about the only way to get around that to achieve a tax benefit from it.
If one, let's say there, and it's not in the case of Bill here, but let's say that one household member, let's say the wife makes $100,000 a year and the husband makes $50,000 a year, is there some advantage to joint filing in that regard?
There is an advantage to joint filing in the sense that you have an advantage. You have the child tax credit and the child care credit and different kinds of credits, education credit, that you couldn't take on a married separate return. That's one of the advantages in that way. For advantages to take a, you know, take the tax code, it's hard to say where their incomes would come. But someone might say, I have the higher income, so I'm going to take all the deductions, and that will bring my income down. And the tax code doesn't allow for one to take all the deductions and the other take the standard and play games with it.
Yeah.
So it's a tough thing to do in the state of Wisconsin to benefit. It's not to say that it won't, you know, there aren't exceptions to that, but the general rule is joint filing is what we do in Wisconsin.
There you go, Bill. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I know one couple I was talking with just the other day, they do all of their, they sort of do an every other year on donations.
Uh-huh.
They pay their, for example, what they give to the church. They give twice as much 1 year and then nothing in the next year.
And that's an excellent strategy to take advantage of getting over the itemized deduction limit in 1 year and being under it and taking the standard and benefiting from the flow. The only thing that you have to be careful of in Wisconsin is if you do not have property taxes in a year, you give up the Wisconsin property tax credits. So there's games that you can play with that, but you have to be careful with that.
Understood. Let's turn to Beth in Montford next. Hi, Beth. Thank you for calling.
Here's my question for the day. It's about my son, Ben. He's 18 and a full-time college student. Ben lives at home, but he managed to make about $8,000 last year. So I have two questions. First is, with that kind of income, can my husband and I still claim him as a dependent? And the second question is, if he puts say $5,000 into an IRA, will he still have to file taxes this year?
It's a good question. Number one, let me address backwards. If Ben has $8,000 of income, he is above the filing requirement, whether he's your dependent, if he's your dependent, certainly. If he is not your dependent, he's below the filing requirement. The fact that he puts the money into the IRA doesn't change that because we're looking at the gross income, which is the $8,000.
Okay.
So next is the dependent side. You said he was age 18.
Yes.
At age 18, we call him a qualifying child. And as long as it takes more than $8,000 to support, more than $16,000 to support him, he certainly could be your child. Now, putting the money in an IRA really says he only has $3,000 available to support himself, to support it. And he's not providing more than half of his own support, because it's probably going to take easily more than $6,000 to support him. The $16,000 might be a little bit harder to come up with.
I see. Okay, and one thing I didn't understand, when you first said that if he is a dependent, then he is below the filing, what would the filing requirement be?
For a dependent, the dependent gets the standard deduction of $6,300. For a single filer who is not a dependent, they have $6,300 plus the $4,050. So there's two different levels. Dependents are treated a little bit differently in filing than a single taxpayer.
Okay.
Does Ben go to school?
Does he go to school?
I beg your pardon?
Does he go to school?
Yeah, he is a full-time student.
Okay.
He's in college full-time.
Again, as you're looking at whether Ben has enough to support himself, be sure that you also consider student loans as you're going through the process. If the loans are loans that he's responsible for, when you're determining whether he pays for more than half of his support, those loan proceeds are part of that discussion.
Okay.
All right.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Appreciate it, Beth. Good questions. Pat in Elm Grove. What's on your mind?
Okay, a friend of mine sold her house for a $30,000 profit, and on the papers that she got at the closing, it said this information is being supplied to the IRS as a 1099, but she has never gotten a 1099 form in the mail. Does she still have to fill out the Schedule D?
If the closing papers said they were reporting the information to the IRS. It's a form 1099-S. I would assume that they did it, whether she has it in her own hands. So as a protection method, I would certainly report that, and it eventually goes to Schedule D, but it starts on a form 8949.
Okay.
But there's a question to ask before that, and that is this her home, her principal residence?
Oh, yes, for many years.
If this is her principal residence, then reporting it is going to be an exercise, and she's not going to have to pay a tax on it.
Right.
And so just reporting it and telling the government, there are special codes on the 8949 that will allow her to identify that that is the sale of her principal residence, for which there is an exclusion.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Wayne emailed to ask if it's possible to sell rental property and do a tax-free exchange by investing in a real estate investment trust. Wondering if these are risky and how would one go about evaluating and choosing one?
Wow. That's a chunk of a question.
Yeah.
Number one, the word sell is a bad word to use when you're talking about an exchange. First of all, rental property can be exchanged for other real estate. And it isn't the case of you selling it, getting the money, and going to buy something else. You have to use, for a like-kind exchange, a qualified intermediary who, in essence, holds the money. The second half of the question, I really am not certain that a real estate investment trust qualifies. I wouldn't say that it wouldn't, but I would have to take a look at it to make sure that it does. I know that during the casualty loss period, there was a special rule that said if I had a rental property destroyed, I could exchange it for an S corporation whose purpose was holding it. But that was a special rule. So with the real estate investment trust, I would need to do some other research. But keep in mind, again, you don't sell the property and take the money to foster this exchange. You need to engage a qualified intermediary to hold the money.
All right. Let's go to Chris in Wisconsin Rapids now. Chris, hello.
Hi. Basically, my question is, I've had some coworkers that have done it because at my job, I drive a ton. I mean, I think I put on about, between driving back and forth to work and then driving on the job, I probably put about 2,000 to 2,500 miles a month on my car. And I'm just wondering, you know, some of them put it on their taxes. I'm always a little bit creeped out by that. I'm worried I don't have the right documentation to do that, so I've never really been brave enough to do it because I don't want to have to go through the hassle of an audit and whatnot. So I basically my question is, what is the best way to go about claiming either gas expenses or mileage on your taxes?
Okay. It's a good question, Chris, and a couple of things that you said we need to address in the situation. First of all, the form for an employee who uses their vehicle for business is a 2106 form. It comes into the tax return through the Schedule A as a miscellaneous itemized deduction subject to 2% of your adjusted gross income. What that means is that in order to have benefit of this expense, you first have to be able to itemize, and secondly, when you do itemize, in order to take the miscellaneous, you have to have a large enough deduction to get over that 2% road. If that is true, looking at the mileage, you have to look at what requirement you have to drive your vehicle. A salesperson, a route person, the salespeople are usually, or truck drivers, are usually the people that we see the most with driving. Number one, your mileage depends on whether you go to work and drive from work for your job, because driving to work is generally a commuting expense which is non-deductible.
Yes.
So if we'll assume that you're driving from, once you get to work, you're going out, it is important that you keep mileage logs.
Okay, so if I use like the mileage log. Oh, and then that's also another thing is our company provides mileage reimbursement.
Okay. There are
I was always worried, is that double dipping if I get mileage reimbursement from my company and then also try to file it on my tax?
You can't do both. On the 2106, you would claim your mileage and subtract out any reimbursement.
Okay.
And currently the rate for 2016 it was 54 cents a mile. So if your company is already paying you 54 cents a mile for all the business miles you drive, there is nothing to gain by doing it. If they pay a lesser number, then you have to look at the value of that.
Yeah, because we're about 10 cents under. We do about 45, so about 9 cents under.
So it would depend on the number of miles that you drive. And also, remember that there are two ways to do it. There is a standard mileage rate, which is the 54 cents for 16, or you can take actual expenses, which involve depreciation and keeping gas receipts and things like that, only on the business part, of course.
Yep.
And you would still subtract the reimbursement from that.
Okay, so probably one of the safest ways would be to just, like, use my car for only work and just track the mileage logs, and so that way any gas I'm putting into that, you know, it's pretty much all for work.
That's great. If your work starts at home, that's no problem. If your work starts at a different location, you have commuting to get to that location.
Okay.
And so it wouldn't be 100% business vehicle.
I remember going through this myself 1 year where I had a little notebook, and I would write down the odometer reading, you know, when I started, where, you know, it was legal to start, and then I'd note it when I finished. I see now that there's an app out there on your phone that you can just sort of enter it in your phone. I don't know if you've seen that or not, Mary.
I have seen that, and whatever works for a person, the most important thing is that if you are claiming that, it is something that you have to have substantiation for it. If you don't, you are playing audit roulette.
Yes, you are. There you go. Chris, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. It's a good question. Well, they've all been good questions. What the heck? David in Neillsville, you're next. Hi, David.
Hi. See, well, we had a very sick little boy. And anyways, he was in Children's Hospital in Milwaukee. And my wife spent over a month down there with him.
Yep.
And, no, she, you know, she stayed at the Ronald McDonald House, so our fees were minimal there. But is there any deduction for, you know, being out of town? I know, like, when I drove semi years ago, I could always deduct when I was out of town.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah, okay.
This is a little bit different than business travel. In medical side, the IRS allows $50 a day to cover meals and lodging while someone is accompanying someone for medical treatment away from home. So the max would be $50 a day for your wife, assuming she had to be there with a minor child.
So about $1,500 for a month.
Okay.
And you would claim that as part of your medical deductions.
Okay.
Keep in mind...
I know we could deduct our mileage.
Your mileage but, to and from certainly is allowed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
And again, keep in mind that medical deductions, part of the Schedule A, and you must meet 10% of your adjusted gross income in order to get over that hurdle.
Oh, okay. So we still have to meet over 10%.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thank you so much. And maybe, you know, given your child's illness, maybe you do. Yeah, you never know. Need to get pencil to paper on that one, David. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Cheryl a chance to join us from Berlin. Cheryl, hi.
Hi. I have two quick questions. My brother died December 16th of 2016, and he wasn't married. He didn't have any children. And his two sources of income was Social Security, and then he had quite a large pension. And I was wondering, do we need to do anything, you know, for taxes?
Definitely. I assume that you're the personal representative for your brother?
Well, not legally. I mean, I'm his sister.
Okay. Is there anyone else that has been appointed the personal representative?
No.
Then whoever is the heir would be responsible to make sure that his 2016 tax return is filed, including any of the income for that year. Then, go ahead.
The only thing, you know, like I said, Social Security, and on his pension, each month $127 was taken off for federal.
Okay. Depending on the size of the pension, that determines the taxability when you look at the whole picture.
Well, it's $1,500 a month.
$1,500 a month?
Yes.
At $1,500 a month, he certainly has a filing requirement.
There is no filing requirement?
No, there is.
No,
I say
there is a filing requirement. And at the very least, even if there were not a filing requirement, you would want to file to get back the withholding. So you need to file, someone needs to file a final return for your brother.
Even though nothing is set up legally?
Somebody,
even if there is no probate estate,
then
the personal representative, the person who is closest in kin, is generally the person who does it. If it's not done, then the money just stays at the IRS.
Okay. And one quick question. My husband and I are both retired. Our income is mostly Social Security. At what point do we need to file a tax return?
For individuals, the standard deduction for a married couple is $12,600 plus two personal exemptions of $8,100. And then over 65, you get additional amounts. So if your income, ignoring Social Security, is under $22,000, you're probably pretty safe and not filing a return.
So you're talking about dividends and things like that.
I'm talking about dividends, pension payouts, rent, any of those things, ignoring Social Security for a minute. If those things are underneath about $22,000 for a married couple, you probably don't have to file a tax return.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Reagan emailed to say that she inherited a small IRA from which she will need to take mandatory withdrawals. 10% will be withheld from the payment for taxes. She's 57 years old. How does she report this on her return?
Reagan will get a 1099-R for that IRA distribution. It will have a special code 4 in the code box that indicates that it is an inherited IRA. And she just files it on her tax return as additional income on the pension line, just like any other income she might receive.
Okay, there we go. Let's turn to Jerry in Waukesha now. Jerry, hello.
Hi. I'm 59 years old. And my financial situation, I've been instructed to invest in just a simple, regular IRA, not a Roth. And I didn't do that before the end of the year. I'm just wondering, is there something like that I can still invest in before a certain date and get credit for last year's?
Yes. The date for investing in either a regular or a Roth, it must be done by April 15th. To be considered in 2016. You have that time period from the first of the year till April 15th to make a prior year contribution. The thing to remember is when you do go to make that contribution, you need to tell the people that you're contributing it with which year you're meaning to put it in. So it's important to tell them prior to April 15th when you go to invest it that it is a 2016 contribution.
Okay, I thought I'd heard something to that effect in the past, but I wasn't really sure. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary Mellum, our guest today, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. Our guest here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking today with Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin, owner of Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals, and certainly here to answer your tax questions. I had a student ask me who was going to be going to work and had heard about a program where you could put tax, you pay the taxes on the money, put it into this program, and then when you drew it out, say 30 years from now, to be tax-free. Is that still in effect? I can't remember the name of the program.
It sounds like you're describing a Roth IRA.
Ah, there we go. That's the one. But that's certainly one for a young person to consider if they're in the right financial situation.
Certainly. Any time, whether it's a Roth or a traditional IRA, any time you can set money aside for retirement, the earlier you can, the more it has a chance to grow.
And the Roth, you know, he's probably at a lower tax rate right now anyway, so
that would be an excellent opportunity.
Yeah, Roth IRA. All right. Brian in Madison, you're next. Hi, Brian.
Hey, good day. Just curious if you have any experience or can recommend. I am comfortable with the solar panel deduction for the solar panels for a not connected to the grid manner, but if the batteries, and I've heard that the batteries are also deductible or part of the 30% tax credit, and not on the official website, but somebody else, you know, if they're not connected to the grid or using the grid to charge those batteries, that they would be part of the 30%, and if you have any experience with taking the credit for insulated cellular shades that don't have a certificate from the manufacturer stating that they're specifically for insulation but bought for that purpose?
Let me address that first. The shades I would stay away from that. There is a credit of $500 minus anything you've taken in the past. This year, 2016, is the last year for the residential energy credit on that basis. And there are specific items, and if they don't have an Energy Star label, that would be my starting point. If they don't have that, I don't believe that they're going to be eligible at all for it. So I would not be taking that one. Second of all, the solar panels. I don't know specifically about the batteries, but one thing I did want to mention about that, you mentioned the 30% for solar energy. This year, I believe we still have the 30% for the solar energy as we know, and it's geothermal and solar and wind and a number of those others. But that percentage is declining, and before you engage in an expensive adventure in that area, be sure to check out which ones. I believe the fuel cell property is one that's going away. And they have decreased the number or the available programs, and the percentage is decreasing in the ongoing years until eventually I believe it will be phased out.
Hmm. So I need to check in on the specifics of you know, what you're getting there, Brian, before you spend the money, I guess.
That's my recommendation.
Okay. Thanks, Brian. Let's turn to Nancy in Janesville next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Good. Well, I'm very curious. How long does it take the IRS to catch up with a family that has not paid their taxes for 4 years from a deceased parent?
So we've got an executor who has not filed the deceased parent's taxes, and it was 4 years ago?
Correct. And what would the penalty be for something like that?
First of all, did a family member died, they didn't file or didn't pay the taxes of that family member?
Correct.
The only reason that other family members would be responsible for that is if there were assets available when that person died that were given to those family members. Because the IRS has the first right to get money, so to speak. Creditors, of course, come in there, too. But IRS, if there was no money, no value in an estate, IRS isn't going to go after family members. So I don't know what your situation is with regard to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not my family. It's my in-law's family.
Sure. But if there were no assets, if these family members didn't get something from the decedent that should have been used to pay the taxes, nobody's going to go after them.
Nobody's going to go after them.
Yep.
But if they walked away with money or valuables, IRS has a right to do it. And once the tax has been assessed, they have 10 years to collect the tax.
Okay.
The IRS has 10 years to collect the tax once it's been assessed.
Once it's been assessed. If returns should have been filed and were never filed, it is an open door.
Forever.
Yes.
Open door forever.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's go to Sean in Brookfield next. Hi, Sean.
Hi. Good morning, everybody. So I have my great aunt passed away. 91 in her sleep, very healthy, long life, no dependents, never married. She, through her will, is allowing my first cousin and I to buy some vacant land in Fond du Lac County. The way the will says is that she wants my cousin and I to buy it for fair market value, which my cousin and I believe, from all the time we spent talking with her, she was going off of the tax records that she always had, which would probably be half of what the quote-unquote, you know, appraisal value is going to be, you know, because those tax numbers are never appropriate to what it would get in the market. So an assessment's being done, or an appraisal, I should say, to figure out what fair market value is as far as the estate's concerned. If the other, I'm not technically considered a beneficiary as far as the payout's going to go for her stuff. We're just allowed to buy the property, my cousin and I. So if the beneficiaries decide to sell the property for what I believe she wanted us to buy it for the 60-some thousand, will they be able to, will the estate or will the individual beneficiaries be able to deduct the difference on their taxes, or would just be the estate's final taxes? Does that make sense?
I guess what you're asking is, if this fair market value is deemed to be higher than what they are going to sell it to you for, can they take a loss?
Right. Can the beneficiary, will each of the beneficiaries benefit in a way, or will it just be the estate that will?
Well, the beneficiaries are the estate.
Okay.
I mean, and it's a timing issue as far as where those things go. But here's the deal. If the property is sold for less than fair market value, there is a loss. And that loss may be able to be allowed, depending on the situation. If the loss is allowed, because sometimes related party losses are not allowed in a case, you may be far enough removed from it that they would be allowed the loss. But assuming the loss is allowed and the property was held by the estate, it would first be reported on the estate as a Schedule D transaction on the estate. That loss would stay with the estate until the estate is disbanded. And so if there is a loss still allowed when it's the estate is settled, that loss would be a carryover that would be passed out to the beneficiaries to be used at some point on their tax return.
Gotcha. I know it's a little muddy yet, but I'm sure we'll work through it. So.
Okay, there you go. Thanks a lot, Sean. Yeah, appreciate the call. There are lines open for you at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. And Mark in Green Bay up next. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity.
Sure.
My wife and I have reached that fun age where we're required to take a minimum distribution from IRAs. Got two questions about that. First of all, do you have to make quarterly payments if you owed no tax in the year before that?
As far as making quarterly payments, you never have to make quarterly payments, but if you don't have enough to pay the tax, you will have a penalty for not paying taxes ahead of time. The penalty might be based, if you pay in more than you owed last year, you may be able to get out of that penalty. I know you referenced the prior year. But you don't have to ever make quarterly estimates. There is a consequence if you don't. IRS wants you to make it, and when you don't and have other sources of it, you pay a penalty. So that's on that side. But keep in mind that RMD is coming out of a retirement program, and most times you're allowed to take withholding out of it, so you could avoid any need to do quarterly payments if you exercise, have withholding taken out of those payments.
Okay, and then is it possible to roll over the minimum requirements into a Roth IRA if you have no other outside income?
No. It is not. If you are the one that is receiving the minimum required distribution, it's not eligible for rollover. The point of an RMD is to get the money out and be taxed.
Sounds good. Thanks for. How about if you tax it, can you then put it into a Roth?
The only way you could put money into a Roth if you have working income to make it eligible for you to have a Roth IRA contribution.
Yeah, you have to be
where that money comes from doesn't matter.
Yeah. There you go, Mark. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Lindsay in Madison, your turn. Hi, Lindsay.
Hi. We just filed our taxes using the TurboTax online, and we got a much higher return than I had anticipated, and it made a huge jump when we did the medical part of the filing. We do get our insurance through the marketplace, and I just am feeling antsy, like, that we shouldn't actually be getting that much back.
I guess if you bought your insurance through the marketplace, there is a premium tax credit. If your income is less when you file your tax return than the amount of the money that you told the marketplace that you were going to earn and you received a subsidy on it, it's possible that you could have gotten a premium tax credit, and that might have been the reason that it increased.
That makes a lot of sense. We definitely did make a little less than we had anticipated.
There you go.
Okay, awesome. Well, then, Dr. Wayne, I'll come back. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Always nice to hear a little laughter and a smile. And, oh, I came out of this a little on the good side.
Well, again, there's all kinds of factors, but that's one that's possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we are talking today with Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Been in the tax business for more than 30 years, and she and her husband David operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals and are enrolled agents. We'll take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Net, and then we'll be back with Mary. You stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your taxes today with Mary Mellum, a tax professional with her husband David own Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. They work with individuals, businesses. They teach seminars. So, and she does a wonderful job. It's great to have her along to talk about your taxes. And all our lines are filled now. The number 1-800-642-1234. Let's take another call and go to Luke in Ashland next. Hi, Luke.
Hey, Larry. Hey, Mary.
Hello.
Quick question. I fill out the homestead credit every year for rental. Mm-hmm. And the last 2 years I've started filing through TurboTax.
Okay.
And I've gotten an email back that says further paperwork required, and I believe that's the form that they need.
Okay.
And I cannot find where to send that in.
Okay. What you're looking for is the submitting the rent certificate?
Yes.
I assume. There's a form WRA that you can print off from the state website, and the WRA is the transmittal form that you would include with the rent certificate, and there is an address in Madison to send that to.
Okay, I did print off the form, and I had my landlord fill it out. That's the form you're talking about?
Well, the rent certificate is a separate form. That you need to have your landlord fill out. That's what the state of Wisconsin needs. But there is a transmittal form, a separate form called a WRA, that you can print out from the website. And on that form, which goes along with the rent certificate, there is an address of where to send it in Madison.
And what is that website?
Just go to your computer and type in Wisconsin Department of Revenue, and you'll find it.
And one more quick follow-up. I did not send it in last year. I did not know that I had to send that in. And apparently I missed the email that said that I had to. Do you think it would be all right if I sent last year's in with this year's?
Send it in separate envelopes. And you may have to resubmit your copy of the credit. I take it you did not get your credit for 2015?
I did.
You received it?
I did, yes.
Then I wouldn't worry about sending it in if you received it.
Okay. I didn't know if they needed that, if they would come back and be like, hey, we need this form.
Normally, if you are claiming the homestead credit, you have to submit an original copy of the rent certificate or a property tax bill, depending on whichever applies to you. And you either have to send it in or scan it and attach it to the email when you're submitting the return. Wisconsin rarely, I mean, they're sticklers on that.
Okay, because I already got my taxes back, and I already got the credit again this year before I even sent the form in.
Then I would say that there's something they're submitting. I'm surprised that you received it without that documentation.
Yeah.
Because I have filled it out in years before this, before I started using TurboTax.
And had sent it in at that time?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's something in TurboTax to do that, but I know that a rent certificate, a signed rent certificate, if you're claiming rent, is expected one way or the other in Madison. So I'm not sure why the credit came through.
Yeah.
Okay. So send it in just to cover myself?
An excellent idea.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling, Luke. Yeah, you want to, might as well send it in. Wendy in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Wendy.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I'm an owner in a 30-unit condo building, and we recently got a $5,000 assessment for some roofing and elevator needs. Is there any benefit to me tax-wise for paying that assessment?
Tax-wise, that assessment is part of the cost basis of your property. There isn't a deduction for it.
Oh,
but in terms of paying the assessment, I would assume that your agreement with the condo association requires you to pay it.
It does. I mean, yeah, any assessments that come up.
It's not a deductible expense. It's part of your cost in your unit.
Okay.
All right, good. Thanks a lot for calling. So you want to hang? You want to keep that information, though, wouldn't you, Mary, for
that
if you
that
sell?
That is correct. Anything that is associated with your residence or any other property that is considered part of the cost basis should be there in case you're going to sell it, that you can determine the real cost basis.
All right.
All right, thank you.
Yep, thanks, Wendy. Appreciate the call. Let's turn to Kathy in Mequonago next. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Larry. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, my mother passed away last March, and I inherited her property, her home, through a transfer on death deed. We did get the property in March, and we sold it in May. So we held on to it for less than 2 months. What are the tax implications for that?
The tax implications for that, since you inherited the property, are probably very minor. The property has a fair market value at the date of death. That technically is your cost basis in it. And that number compared to what you sold it for, generally the difference between those two is the gain that you would pay on that sale of the property.
If there was no difference, do I have any forms to file or do I just not do anything?
If there is no difference, you wouldn't have any gain. I would recommend that you report it on your tax return because generally any time property is sold, there would be a 1099-S generated. And if it's not on your tax return, the IRS could come back and ask for it. Even though there is no gain on it in your situation, it would still take the time to respond to it because they would assume that there was because they would know different. No.
Is there a reason I didn't get a 1099-S?
The only reason that brokers on the sale of real estate don't have to issue 1099-S's is if it's your principal, if you sign a document presented by them that says it's your principal residence and you've lived in it for more than 2 out of the last 5 years, the gain is under $250,000, and you've never used it for business. And those situations shouldn't apply to your particular scenario.
Okay, so even though I don't have that 1099-S, just to put it on the tax form, is there a particular line I put it on?
You should report it on the form 8949 in the long-term section.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much for your help.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Garrett in Baldwin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about inheritance. My sister passed away, and me and my remaining sister got inherited her IRA. Now, mine, I'm going to transfer that to an inherited IRA and take the RMDs. We're both under 65. But my sister is, the will stated that to go into a trust fund. She has special disabilities. Now, does the trust fund have to consider that income and pay the full amount, or is there a way to get that into like an inherited IRA for distributions?
Well, there would be an inherited IRA. I don't believe that the trust has to take all of the money out at once. That trust, that your sister can be the beneficiary through her trust. I don't believe there should be any problem in leaving it in an inherited IRA and having it taken out of over your sister's life expectancy.
Okay, but my sister passed away, so that inherited IRA goes, I mean, the money is distributed to the trust.
The money, if your other sister is the beneficiary of the trust, the money is going to your other sister through the trust. And are you getting some pushback from the brokerage that says we can't do this?
Basically, yes.
Okay.
They're saying they can roll it over into another IRA, or we can get a disbursement.
Okay. Well, that's what you would be rolling it to a beneficial IRA in the name of yours for your interest, and that's where the minimum distributions would be coming out based on your life expectancy. And I believe the same can be done through the trust, because the trust, it should be a look-through of the trust to see who the beneficiaries of the trust are.
Okay, so the trust itself will be kind of like the inherited IRA and doesn't have to pay taxes until it's dispersed to the beneficiary?
Well, no. The amounts that are coming out of the trust for the beneficiary go to the trust. That amount, like your minimum required, is taxable to the trust. And if the trust distributes to your sister, it will be taxable to your sister. If it stays in the trust will pay taxes on it.
Okay, I'm a little confused. Let me see if I can simplify it. The trust is that my sister's, who passed away, inherited IRA, is being dispersed to my other sister's trust.
I understand that.
Okay. Now, so say it's $50,000 in the trust.
Now, hold on. If it is being dispersed and the trust gets $50,000, the trust pays taxes on it, period.
Okay.
And it could flow through. But the step before that is, if the trust is the beneficiary of this IRA, I'm not aware of a reason, because there is a beneficiary of the trust, that account couldn't stay as a beneficial IRA. But if the brokerage is saying they won't make it that way, I would be asking what law they're citing to say that. And they may have something, I'm not aware of it, but I would be checking on that.
Okay, so and since the brokerage should have like an inherited IRA for the trust, or?
Yes, that would be that, unless they're saying that they can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was my impression, they're saying that they can't do that.
I would be asking for proof of that first.
Okay, all right, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for calling, appreciate your call. Let's go to Judy in Franklin now. Judy, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. My question is fairly straightforward. I do a lot of volunteer work, and I have been tracking my miles and my hours spent. What, if any, can I claim for reimbursement for charity?
I think you're using the word reimbursement to mean deduction on your tax return.
Yeah, whatever it's called.
Volunteer miles are deductible at the rate of 14 cents a mile.
Okay.
Hours worked are pennies for heaven, not
okay,
for anything on the tax return.
I do.
Okay.
So if I have 1,000 miles, then it's 14 cents a mile.
Yep.
That is correct.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call as well. Kathleen in Fifield, thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Hi, Mary. Yeah, this is the year that I need to use my RMD. I've got my paperwork here, and I just have a couple of simple questions. Is there a benefit to how you take it out, whether it's monthly, quarterly, semi-annually? Is there any benefit to one or the other?
Tax-wise, it's not going to make a difference because the total amount is going to come onto your tax returns. So for tax purposes, that really doesn't make any difference. The only thing I could say is if you were setting up estimated tax payments or something like that, that you wanted something in one quarter versus another. But generally the taxation doesn't matter how you get it.
Okay. Also, is there any benefit to withholding the tax? I mean, I would be responsible for filing that the next year then, correct? For
when you were saying your RMD is ready, it's for 2017?
They'll start this year.
Okay. Yes. So in 2017, the priority or the decision of whether to withhold or not is more of a convenience factor.
Okay.
If you withhold it, you don't have to come up with it at the end of the year. Depending on your tax situation, it would be figured into your estimated tax calculation if you don't have it withheld.
Okay, I'm one of those who would rather just pay as we go. And it says that there's a 10% minimum, apparently, on federal. Do you know if Wisconsin requires state taxes out of it?
Yes, Wisconsin requires state taxes. It is subject to income tax for Wisconsin purposes. So the Wisconsin part of it would be important. And Wisconsin rate, generally, we figure about 6%. You know, kind of it can vary, but 6% is a nice number if you're setting up withholding to come out of your RMD.
Okay. And now the amount that they tell me that I need to take out, that they're basing that on the year. Is that correct?
Well, it's a combination. The amount that you take out is the balance in the IRA at the end of the prior year, so it would be 12/31/2016, divided by a factor that is determined by your age.
Oh, I see.
And
okay.
The first year is 27.4.
Okay. Well, now, the amount that they tell me that it, I mean, the minimum amount that they're making me take out, now, would that if I take it monthly, they would divide 12 into that. They wouldn't
That's
be taking
correct.
Giving me that amount each month. Is
no,
that?
No. They would determine your RMD for the year, and then however you decide to take it, they would divide it by that to get your payments.
Okay, that was pretty much my basic question. Okay, well, I'll let you go. I appreciate that very much.
All right, thank you very much for calling. Julie and Nina, your turn. Hi, Julie.
Hi, thank you. I have a quick question. My mother passed away early 2016 and had very limited income, and you've touched on that. However, she had some bonds that were in my name and her name that were cashed that ended up with like $11,000 of interest. When I believe it was the 1099 was issued. It was issued in her name instead of mine. And I'm wondering if we can go back to the bank and ask that it be issued in my name or how we would go about doing her taxes, because otherwise I don't even think she would have to, put a tax return in this year.
Okay. Let me ask the timing of the cashing in of the bonds. Were they cashed in before your mother died or after your mother died?
That's a good question. I think it was after.
Okay. If they were cashed in after your mother died, it would be an estate issue, a 1041, not on her federal tax, not on her 1040 return. You can go back to the bank and ask them to reissue them in your name. They may not. But if it is in her name, then they should be reported on the 1041, and if they belong to you, there's a concept called nominee interest, and it would you would do a nominee 1099 from the estate or from her estate to you to get it onto your tax return and off of hers.
Okay, when you say estate, there really is no estate. Everything was already, you know, in our names, the children's names.
Well, apparently, whatever the bank saw when they cashed it in, they saw her name.
Yes, and the bonds were made in both names. It would say her name or my name.
Then if they can reissue you, it would be simpler. But if they can't reissue it, then that 1099 is going to come in her name. And because it was after she died, there is a form 1041, which is an estate income tax return. That is for income tax or for reporting any income earned on the property after someone dies.
Okay. You'd think they'd be able to reissue those because it's on the bond, it says one name or the other. So, but that's just my logic. It may not be correct.
If they issue it to the, you know, issue the 1099 and the IRS gets it in her name, she's going to get letters. You're going to get letters, and the situation's going to have to be taken care of. So a nominee distribution from one to the other is the way to go if the bank won't reissue it, so it comes on your return where it belongs.
Okay. That makes good sense. We haven't touched on education credits too much. There's a form. What is that form? 88-something?
8863.
And so if you... What's the background on those education credits?
Okay. In 1996, the education credits were created. They were called the HOPE credit and the Lifetime Learning credit. Right now, the Lifetime Learning credit continues as it is, and it's 20% of the first $10,000 of expenses. The HOPE credit has evolved. The HOPE credit is now called, and has been for some time, the American Opportunity Credit, and it is a credit of maximum $2,500. It's 200% of the first $2,000 and 25% of the next $2,000, total of $2,500. The important thing about the credits, for the American Opportunity Credit, it is for tuition and books for students who have not completed their bachelor's degree. They have four years that they can take that credit. The important part is a lot of people know about the credits, but the 1098-T that comes out from the college is a little bit deceiving, and IRS is focusing on it very much.
So pay attention to that.
The box 2 says amount billed. If you are going to pick up that number for the credit, be careful because the amount billed might not be the amount paid, and it is based on the tuition paid.
On that note, we're out of time, Mary. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Mary Mellum of Eschwabenen Tax Professionals, Green Bay, our guest today. And thank you for listening.